This tape was recorded at Sober Village 19, Club Med Cancun, in February 1998. For a free catalog of these and other tapes on recovery, call Inner Light Productions toll-free number 1-800-537-6767.
Welcome to the Sober Village meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Manfred, I'm an alcoholic. It asks here, are there any other alcoholics and Al-Anons present? Would you please join me in the serenity prayer? God.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism.
The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. It is a custom at this meeting to read a portion of Chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, Pete has been asked to read this for us.
Hi, I'm Pete. I'm an alcoholic. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. These are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one thing, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us have been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our lives. B, that probably no human could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
The 12 traditions are to the group what the 12 steps are to the individual. Today, Marky has been asked to read these for us.
I am Marty Alcoholic.
I'm Marty.
The 12 traditions. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only AA requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Ten, Alcoholics Anonymous has no outside opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before our personalities.
The format of today's meeting is the leader qualifies for 5 minutes, followed by the main speaker. My name is Manfred. I'm the alcoholic.
Hi, Manfred.
Hi, folks. Hi, friends. Hi, family. Steve asked me to speak, and I tell you, that got my nerves a little bit shaky. But louder? Something wrong? This? Closer? Good. When I was about 10 years old, I admired a guy who was a man in charge of a little high-riser in Frankfurt, Germany, and he lost his arm in the war. And he could hang on the streetcar, what you had later on in San Francisco, the streetcars where he could hang on. And he was hanging on with his one arm. And I would have swapped with him his spirit and that what I saw in him for that what was sick in me, and would have given an arm. And I knew something was wrong, and it was severely wrong. Alcohol at some time saved my life. Otherwise, I would be a young kid who would have committed suicide. And it saved it for a while, and I never really fitted in. even in the military. I wanted to go to America, my old dream. I wrote my first short story with 10 of a runaway going to America. That takes me too long when I tell you here. I went to the military. I did not drink like the others. I retrieved, I came back, and I drank quite a bit. I was married with 21, had a son, and had some responsibility. And I drank like a fish, and I did evening university, and I made something what commonly is known as a career, and I was dying. And with 26, I came to in a sanatorium because I collapsed and was unconscious, and I was there for 8 weeks because my liver didn't function anymore. They said, you cannot drink for a year. I said, no problem. I didn't drink for a year, and I drank on day 366 and and did that till I was 32. That was in 75. I called AA in Frankfurt and said, I need help. And the guy was a former mercenary, I think it is, one of the foreign legion, and he dried up in chaining himself to an oven in the basement. And he thought everybody has to do that way. And so he asked me, do you have the sweats? And I said, well, yeah, I'm not. And then he said, do you have the shakes in the morning? I said, well, I feel I'm dying, but not really the shakes, no. And then he said, do you have dry heaves? And I said, no, no dry heaves. He said, drink a few more years and come back. So I drank a half a year longer, and I really, it was ugly. And I called in a sort of twilight zone. I was drinking Beck's beer and Christmas Bock around Christmas in huge amounts. And I did not get really drunk, and I was drunk. And I called Hamburg, AA Hamburg, and said, I fly up tonight, I need help. And they said, no, you can't do that in Frankfurt. And then I came, and I said, no, I don't want to, because they want me to drink, and I don't want. So, but I went to a meeting, it helped me. There was a man who followed me when I went out to our meetings there. And he said, you seem not to be convinced. And I said, no, and so I was drinking that night with him, and he had coke, and he saved my life first time. I relapsed after 6 years in Martinique in a Club Med in Martinique. I saw two Americans drinking at the end of an island and said this evening, thank you very much, God, that I'm not drinking. The next day I drank. And I was in and out for 6 years and drinking. My last drink was October 10th, 1988, and I continued with sleeping pills. I was on machines. I was literally dying. And I thought I could never be... can never function again. 400 yards took me 55 minutes to walk, and that was recovery already. So, and I came back to AA, to you folks, and I thought, I'm too wacky. I'm too crazy. I cannot. But it was you took me, and you're my family, and I don't know how many I did of these, six or seven. And you're definitely my battery charger. When somebody asks me here at the club, what are you doing? Do you horseback riding or whatever? I said, no, I'm here for really AA, and that is where what helps me, what helps me to survive. I definitely have felt that I have a deadly disease. I don't want to relapse, and I cannot relapse. And there's one little thing, and then I stop. Yeah, I think I did it. It is about a store, and it has AA on it, all appliances, and the guy comes in, and there is the servants are all angels, and in the corner says something about Al-Anon. I'm not sure, but they are all angels. And he said, what do you sell here in this store? And they said, everything you want. And he said, oh, I want a new wife, I want a new job, I want $1 million, and on top of it, I really want that everybody is in peace. And the angels said, well, we don't sell the whole thing, we only sell the seeds, and that is what I find here. And I want to, and I thank you for being here, and now, thank you. And tonight, I'm pleased to introduce the speaker, Father Terry.
Hello, my name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
And I'm grateful to be sober, grateful to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to say that I'm not so surprised that I'm sober, but I'm surprised that I'm grateful to be sober. Because when I began drinking, my first reaction was, this is too good to be true, something's going to happen. I didn't drink till I was 21. I had from the time I was 10 till I was 21. And I am one of those people who was an alcoholic out of the gate. I do want to mention this one personal thing, and my sort of a family alcoholism thing I mentioned over in our service there. My father was born in 1903 on February the 5th. And my father died on February the 5th, 1945, in withdrawal in the sanitarium. And for whatever was a sanitarium in 1945 on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. And he had been in the program on and off and had a slip. In 1945, I was kind of young. But I had already, I don't think I knew he was an AA. I didn't know about AA when I was six and a half. But I already heard about alcoholism, and I heard that it's a disease, and I heard that the first drink gets you drunk, and I heard that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and my mother was already irritating me by saying, easy does it, one day at a time, and I knew what my daddy died of. And part of my early story is just this, that I, that for a family in Hawthorne, California, in the mid-40s, it was unusual for a kid to get a big in-depth orientation about alcoholism, but that's what went on. The first serious conversation I remember around the breakfast table, kitchen table, was on this stuff, disease concept. And I had an uncle who got in the program. I went to meetings with him, one of my mother's brothers. I looked at his amends list, and this impressed me very much. He had about 10 names and the amount of money he owed people, and he was paying that off. I thought, these people are tough. This is serious. My mother pointed out sober alcoholics in the neighborhood for us to admire. I mean, I had the most positive introduction to the disease and the concept of alcoholism as you can imagine. I gave it a lot of thought, too. It's on my mind a lot. I remember in about, must have been around the third grade, fourth grade, when I was getting more and more concerned about my own salvation, that I thought having this disease might be good at the end, when you come before the judgment seat, and just before the hammer goes down the last time, say, wait, had a disease, couldn't help it. I thought that's the way I was thinking when I was nine. So imagine what my mind is capable of now. And so I had this on my mind a lot. And I grew up, I'd taken the pledge not to drink that Catholic kids took, and hardly any of them kept. Everybody told me, they did that at confirmation. It was kind of a Catholic version of just saying no. that Irish bishop started out, and kind of went through 30s, 40s, 50s, and I took him up on it. I took the pledge not to drink till I was 21. And everybody said, don't worry, nobody keeps the pledge. Have a drink. But I kept it, and I did not drink, and I read about alcoholism as I went along. And became went to the seminary to study to be a priest. While I was in college, I wrote a paper on alcoholism, went to meetings for research. I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years before I had a drink. and a bunch of other books. Became the village expert in alcoholism. Any questions? I discussed this with anybody. It was one of my hobbies. Airplanes and alcoholism were my two avocations. And with that kind of background, the calendar took me up to my 21st birthday. And I knew it didn't slip by me unnoticed, I'll tell you that. But I knew this was the day. My birthday falls in the summertime, and I was out of the seminary. It was I was grateful for that, because they didn't allow drinking inside the school. Not against our religion, by the way. Some of you were sinners from the start, weren't you? We're never supposed to start. Catholics can drink. We're known for that. A little tough on sex, but you can have a drink. So I noticed it was my 20th birthday. It was the day. And I went to the store and bought a bottle of bourbon, sweet vermouth, bitters, maraschino cherries. Got the recipe book out of U.S. News and World Report. Remember the old-timers here remember Southern Comfort ads that had the recipes for America's 16 most beloved cocktails. And 1.5 ounce of this and a dash of that. And I worked this out, Matt, and multiplied the stuff and was very careful about the recipe. And somebody mentioned that I probably would not have any trouble with my drinking because nobody in my family's history had taken that much trouble to make a drink up until that point. The last time I took that much trouble, too. But that's the day when I had my first couple of Manhattans. I discovered America or something along that line. I have no words to describe. It is wordless. It's deeper. It isn't that we like drinking. You know, this is revelation time. This is a new conversion experience. This is a new thing. But it's funny. At the same time, when I got that first rush, I kind of thought it might be like this. You know, I remembered it from someplace. But boy, the message was, whatever you do, keep the world safe for drinking. Make sure you can get a drink. Do not discuss this with anybody. They will not understand. They don't deserve a drink. You can tell by the way these other people drink. They don't deserve the drink they have. They don't appreciate it. You just make sure you keep the line open. You know. And I got the message. That first day, it was when it hit bottom. Part of the message to me was, they can't get you now. I like that. Well, who can't get you? I don't know, but I know they can't. I became immune. You know, some people said they became bulletproof, and I wasn't worried about bullets. It weren't on my mind. Public humiliation was on my mind. And that I felt I was immune to that. And I also, my IQ went up about 25 points, I think. And I became deeply convinced that anything I'd say would be interesting. I consider this one of God's crueler tricks on the world. Because there's two things that happen when someone like me has a drink or a drug, and they happen simultaneously. I feel like I become interesting and actually become boring at the same instant. It's the right when I start feeling interesting, I'm impaired enough to be boring and repetitive and pain in the ass. And anyway, it's just one of the nature's dirtiest tricks. And that was it. It wasn't it. It was it was a rush that was a symptom of the disease of alcoholism, and yet I, my self-consciousness about this whole thing, and this is me commenting, of course, who knows, but my understanding is that this, the very fact that I just loved it so much and was so, and it just carried away by it, at the same time it said, you be careful, you know, this is really good. Whatever you do, do not become an alcoholic. They can't drink at all. Be careful. So I set out to be careful and not become an alcoholic. I was a full-blown alcoholic that afternoon, you know, with insufficient socialization, you know, to get liver damage right away. But I went on a lot in my seminary, and I had friends who didn't drink hardly anything. I had no money. Lots of studies, and in the school they allowed no drinking, and I went ahead and did my studies and enjoyed them. But the one thing about, I don't know if it's changed or not, Cliff might know, but in my time in high school and college, any boy who enjoyed reading or studies was deeply suspect. And so none of us who liked it ever would admit it. But I enjoyed it. I really liked it. As one of the, young teenager being grateful, I was grateful to God that I got to go someplace where I get to read and study a lot and no one bothers me. And, you know, where I can do this and get fed. I was thrilled. And then when alcohol entered the scene, as long as I didn't have a drink that day, I wasn't thinking of it. We're famous for that. People don't understand that. When we know we can't get a drink, usually we calm down. Yeah, it's all right. You know? But then when it was my turn to get a drink, in my head, this was the day I got to do it. Well, you know, watch out. I will assert my rights. You know, the time went on. I had drinking episodes in my student days. I drank alcoholically all the time because I'm alcoholic. But the style was different. I had two principal styles of drinking. One was the real booze fighter type of style, you know, where you're keeping track of everything. A booze fighter to me is somebody who's trying to get as much to drink as I possibly could in order to make sure I did not get drunk. And if you keep both of those goals in mind simultaneously, you've got a lot of math to do. You've got a lot of measurements. You have to time the minutes between drinks and the percentage of alcohol in the drink and the circumference of the glass and the displacement of ice and where your car is and how much money you got in your pocket and who it is you're talking to. Try to keep track of this. It's a matter of keeping track. And if you keep track of things, it means you have a chance. You have a chance to get through in some kind of, with some kind of dignity left. And I could get very drunk while I was trying to keep track of things. You can get drunk and die, right, while you're trying to be good. You know? Generally, I would drink less when I was trying hard. But then the other mode of drinking I had is when I would lose interest in keeping track of things. You know, this classy meeting, Arrowhead, Speaker Water. I'd say to myself, usually I care when I'm supposed to get up tomorrow in the morning. I wonder why I don't care tonight. No. Usually I care what freeway I'm on. I wonder why I don't know, where is this? You know. Usually I care who I'm talking to, and I don't care who you are. And when I would get into that not care zone, I liked it. I think maybe that's one of the reasons I drank. I was hoping to get into the, you know, total freedom. Swan dives off the cliff. Unfettered. Not held down. I loved it. And I also Now, this is the little analytical part. People who speak, and they speak a long time, they get to indulge themselves in these analytical asides. But when I first drank, the first drinking experiences I had were accompanied by like a cloud over my head, a kind of a depressive thing going on. And I was just vaguely aware of that. And it was after I was sober for a while in the program, it occurred to me that the minute I began to get high, I realized down deep that I was going to have to come down. Now, I don't want to come down. I want to get high and a little higher and a little higher and break into the sunlight and see the face of the living God. That's all. I don't want to have them say, the bar's closed. I don't want this over. And so the minute I would begin to drink, I would be kind of depressed. And if someone were asking me, you know, why are you, you look a little bit down, right, while you're getting high, what's going on? I couldn't have put it into words, but I think the feeling was, I'm down because I can't stay loaded forever. I'd like to stay loaded forever. And then you just kind of know what they'd say, nod and back away from you. And that kind of thing. But another thing about this the negative, the deep disturbance deal, that's one thing. I wanted to stay loaded forever. And this other thing about once you go into that mode of I don't care, I'm not keeping track of things. I don't care. Well, something registers negative with that one too. And I think the significance of not caring is you're a dead man. I think my body knows before my head does. My body knows in my early alcoholic drinking, I think my body knew that I was a dead man. That if you don't care where you step, you're going to... In fact, if you don't care where you step around here, you're going to go right off a thing really quick and break your neck on the... about 4 feet down. Anyway, if you don't care what side of the double line you're on, you'll go across it. If you don't care when you get up, if you don't care, you'll die. And I think, you know, the old thing about alcoholics have a sense of impending doom. I think the reason we have a sense of impending doom is that doom is impending. It's built into the deal. I have a tidal force pulling me to poison myself at every available opportunity and put myself out of commission for any meaningful human contact and become incompetent deeply for normal things. That means you're going to not live very long. Anyway, that's my little commentary. And then... my student years went on, and I messed around. I was already doing my funny stuff, you know, the alcoholic playing games, chapter 3 stuff. When I was still a student, I took another pledge not to drink. They wanted us to take a pledge not to drink for 5 years. They thought it would be good for young priests not to drink. And so this was a couple years before ordination, and I thought, man, I just got over the other pledge. But they permitted us to do a conditional type one, you know, do something that limits your drinking. Oh, okay, I'll do that. And so far, I really like Manhattans and that kind of thing. So I made this pledge that I'd never drink any more than one hard drink in any one day. Didn't like beer. Couldn't imagine drinking wine. That's how early this was. And and so I took that pledge. Well, that led me to two things resulted immediately. One is that I learned to love beer. and the other is that I invented some of the largest drinks ever put together in Western world. And one of them was my buddy Dorian. He was a classmate, partner in crime, and it was the summertime. We both had jobs. He lived at this place where he worked, over a garage in a parish where he was the handyman, and I was working in a factory, swimsuit, Rosemary Reed swimsuit, the old thing. And he got a hold of a bottle of 151 rum, you know. And I thought, you know what we should do with this is make zombies the way they never had the nerve to. So we got two flower vases and some fruit juice, and then a pint of light and a pint of dark regular, and mix that all up, and then put the Demerara rum on top. And then we drank these two things. And when we were done, my buddy was lying on his back on the floor, peacefully. And I looked at my watch, and it was 11:45, and I thought, good, only 15 minutes till tomorrow's drink. And I think that's diagnostic, you know, that there is no possible way a person could find himself in that position and not be alcoholic. You know, why would you do the thing that, you know, it's the cases could be closed, but I didn't have enough of a story yet, you know, to call up the program. And I was ordained a priest, and I live and work as a priest in Los Angeles, I want to say right now. These days. And I went down the tubes quickly. My story, I kind of embellished my story with you know, I don't know, just my neurotic introspective comments. But when you get right down to it, I have a very dull story. You know, I'm an alcoholic who was a booze fighter and who wrestled around with it and was strangled and just yanked down the rat hole of alcoholism. I was in a parish and I was very serious about my vocation. Was having drinks before dinner with the pastor. He drank Old Forester Bonded. Eventually, right now, one of my jobs is to be an EAP for clergy, and that's the employee assistance program type of person who does interventions, and I wound up doing interventions on almost all the old priests that I admired, especially this one. I really liked the guy, and he was an alky, and I went down the tubes fast. I say I was my own chapter 3 included things like finding myself at the social occasion, the party where they're having booze, and it was over. Good night, over, goodbye. You know, and I didn't mind leaving. It's fine with me. It's just that I wasn't done yet. And we alcoholics have a job to do, and we are required to get done before we're allowed to go to bed. And so I had to get done. And you either bar hop your way home, buy your own bottle, or steal something. Those are the ways. I never had a supply. I never had a supply. If I had a supply, it would always be gone when I woke up. And I didn't have enough money to get a supply. You know, it was just never any depth to my and so I was making my resolutions, and I began to make resolutions not to drink too much at different places, and I had a paradoxical reaction to making resolutions. And I'll tell you the punchline, then explain it. The punchline is that when I succeeded, I was depressed, and when I failed, it felt all right. Because when I made a resolution not to drink too much in an evening, and then just was successful, I did it. I didn't drink too much. I just had a few drinks. I'd just be a nervous wreck. I just know this is way too much work and no fun. And I knew down deep I'm going to lose interest in this project. I know that. I mean, this is not what I want to do. I felt more like a failure when I succeeded. And when I just make my resolution and get drunk, I'd say, well, at least I tried. That's a paradoxical reaction. And so I was doing other chapter three things. I would remember going to confession to an old Franciscan priest, San Fernando, and he said to me, "Young man, take my advice. Never take another drink for the rest of your life. I know your type." Last time I went to confession to him, I found a guy in Burbank who was more understanding, could talk more, could talk it over. I remember his transfer to South Central Los Angeles right before the Watts riot in 65. And continued drinking. I created a problem for a priest who is now a bishop, younger than me. The bishop, when you're getting older, the bishops get younger, doctors are younger. This guy had a room next to mine in this rectory, and he didn't drink much, but he had a bottle of scotch. I happened to find out where his bottle of scotch was. It was, he had it in his little study. We had studies right next to each other. And I'd run out in awkward times when it was tough to get a resupply. And I would sneak over there, and he had this cheap scotch. It was King George IV or something, It was pitiful. If he knew about it, he'd be embarrassed, but he didn't. He was so stupid about drinking, he didn't. And so I would borrow some of this. And then for the two reasons of wanting to be fair and make restitution, I would fill his bottle back to the place I figured it was when I borrowed it. And I didn't want to be cheap, I'd give him a little bonus. And of course, the real motive was that I would have a reservoir again. I'd always have a backup place. Well, I was doing this a number of times, and I had no idea that I was creating a serious problem in this man's life, because he had the scotch bottle that never got empty. he was really relieved to find out what was going on. But while I was there, I went down quickly. I was... After having quit drinking for about little less than six months, I quit cold. And it was just, no program. When a young alcoholic quits and there's nothing, you don't tell anybody you quit. You just quit and don't drink. We need meetings. And I had no idea. I was very impressed, though, that I quit drinking. I thought I was finally getting spiritual, that I was, finally growing up, becoming mature, and it was just as bad as I thought it was going to be. I don't know about you, but there's two words that send chills up my spine, and they still do. Maturity, responsibility. I'm just going to cringe. I cringe down deep with both those things. They don't sound like fun to me. But towards the end of this five and a half months period, I had an attitude shift from being proud of being spiritual to getting a little concerned that I just might stick to this. And I might have just jumped the gun a bit, quit a little early. I thought, if I don't drink for the whole rest of my life, it may not be good for me. They might just find me babbling in a corner and no one will know what happened. He waited too long to have a drink. So I thought, since I'd quit for over 5 months, I had proved that I could quit. I had the talent to quit. I had the willpower, whatever it is. I had what it takes to quit. So as long as I knew I had that, I might as well start. Because if there's any trouble, I'll just quit fast. And if that makes any sense to you, you're in the right place this week. And it was just real fast after that. It was real fast. I was quitting a lot. I sure didn't get to 5 months after that. 2 days, drink three. Quit five, drink one. Drink five, quit one. You know, I quit so much that if someone offered me a drink, I wouldn't know if I was drinking or not. I'd have to say, just a minute, let me figure it out. God, I hope I didn't quit today. I finally got to the point where I thought, you know, you're quitting too much. That's your trouble. If you quit drinking for life more than 10 times a month, it will affect your self-esteem. And I thought if I just accepted myself as a drinking person, and I could smooth it out. And I wouldn't feel such a failure and so guilty. When I drank, I just, no, you're a drinking person. You know, adjust. And, you know, so I tried that. And then I was into the last phase of my pre-going public phase. And I was drinking a fifth of scotch a day in this little parish in South Central Los Angeles. And mixing it with pills when I could. You know, I had a real bad back and got some Percodan. Remember one time thinking, I gotta stop drinking. I gotta do this service with all the kids in church this afternoon. So I just stopped and had a few drinks in the morning and then had about 3 or 4 hours of stopping. And I thought, well, I'll be such a wreck, a nervous wreck, I might as well take a few Percodan and that'll smooth me out. That smoothed me out enough where I didn't really care that much about not drinking. And I don't know what happened during that service. It was, I didn't get arrested or anything, but it was, I remember trying with all my might to keep consciousness, you know. And finally, I was missing things, and my boss knew, and he was confronting me, and I was saying, I won't drink anymore, but then I would. And drinking at that rate, and I was getting into the different kinds of trouble, doing things that alcoholics are known to do. And I was, dead inside. I don't want to make too much of this because I never feel like people identify with this very much. But the awful thing about drinking alcohol, the awful thing about alcoholic drinking is alcoholic drinking. It's not getting in a wreck later or having cirrhosis of the liver, and that's bad. I mean, that's no joke, but just the experience of drinking alcoholically is so bad that it's a relief to get into trouble, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you just luck out. If you get into trouble, then it's wonderful. And just as I was leading up to being into trouble, you know, drinking about a fifth a day, I'd be, a fifth a day is way too much and not nearly enough. It's too much, okay, anybody know that? But it's not nearly enough because it's less than a quart. I mean, you hardly ever get a drink. If you make it stretch through the whole day and night, I mean, for 24 hours, a fifth is not that much. And I had a feeling I got a drink about one out of every five times I really needed one. I'd get one, you know. Yeah, easy does it, you know. And yet, the effect it had, besides just being intoxicated, was just the deadness, you know. And I think, you know, to be alive, you need to breathe in and breathe out. For a stream to be alive, you got to have fresh water in, you got to have water go out. You got to have, you know, the nutrients in, energy out, waste out. There's exchange. And when I'm drinking on an emotional and spiritual level, I die. Because I can't do those things. I can't get out what I have to get out. I can't tell the truth. Everything's top secret material. What can you say? You know, if people ask how you feel, you know, not they usually don't want to know, but when they say, how are you doing? Don't tell them how you feel. But so when they stop and turn around and say, you know, you're looking peaked. what's wrong with you? How are you feeling? Well, I feel like an inexorable and irreversible process of disintegration has taken hold. And I'll be dead soon. How are you doing? And we know that's not a good way to start a conversation. So I say, I'm fine. Or worse, I found myself complaining, bitching and moaning about things in my life that I didn't even care about. Because I was negative, so I had to complain about something. You know, my boss, you know what he did? They say, oh, really? What? I'm already bored with the conversation. You know, and it's my stuff. You know? You can't even tell the truth when somebody is mature, smart, loving, and has the time. Because if you start really doing your best to tell the truth to a person like that, they'll try to help you. And it's a lot harder to get a drink when they're trying to help you than it is usually, you know. I can't get it out, and I can't let stuff in. You know, I was sober for years before this hit me, and when it hit me hard. As I was sober for a while and talking to drunks, you know, and I'm the one sober, you're the one, the other person's the one loaded on alcohol or Valium or something. And that reminded me, brought me back to my childhood of being trapped by my Uncle Bill in the corner and being bored to death. And I thought, you know, when you talk to drunk, you don't get your turn in the conversation. You finally say what you have to say, and they just plow on. They don't give you anything back to let you know that they heard what you said. But I usually have the feeling, well, I got to reword this, you know. And you try it again, and they just plow on, and they give you nothing. And I thought, and finally it hit me, that is me. That's me when I drink. I can't listen. I cannot afford to be vulnerable enough to let what you say affect me because I'm just hanging on. I can barely make it with the usual stuff. And I can't afford to have new material to respond to. You know, I've just barely got enough to take care of the old stuff. I can't. I'm all for you. I hope you do all right, you know. It's just that I don't have anything left to actually care. I just can't care right now, okay? Later maybe, but too bad. Good luck. That's drinking on a good day, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And the good days stopped. I was, they kind of came, they got me after about four showdowns. The showdown with the Cardinal. I was relieved of my post, and you lose your assignment. That's our euphemism for getting fired. Getting fired is always a big deal. Even if you can get a job fast, we don't like to get fired. But if you live where you work and drive a company car, it's more of a deal than usual. Getting fired. And so I was on hold for a while, and they were still talking to me. And they said, well, if you go to this aversion treatment hospital, and we'll think about giving you another assignment. So I went, and I had this called intervention, and I went like as a good sport. I went through this thing where they give you a nausea drug, warm salt water, something to drink, you throw up violently and get this condition deal about nausea and the taste and smell of alcohol. But I went through that like a champ. I'm very good at hospitals. I got done. I was embarrassed. They caught me. I thought I should have caught this on my own with God's help. And I got back. They assigned me to another place, 100 and some miles away. And I settled down. I wasn't even nervous. I thought, I'll never drink. Everybody knows. It's clear. I mean, you're such an alky. They told me you're alcoholic. Of course I am. You know, the first drink gets you drunk. Let me tell you. You know, I had no trouble with the label alcoholic. It's fine. Across my forehead tattoo, fine. I'm alcoholic. But there was something down there. I had no program. And I didn't even think of going to AA because I thought they'd just tell me what I already knew. You know, that you're alcoholic. Da, da, da. I know that. And then some Methodist would try to explain that I needed a higher power. And so I lasted about 40 days and was drinking again. And the I was invited to a dinner. They wanted to check out the new guy in this parish. I've been there just a short time. And so the pillars of the parish, one of the main people in the parish invited me to Sunday afternoon dinner. And I started drinking the previous Thursday evening. And I kind of kept it up. I kind of, I didn't want to lose the glow. And all I could drink was wine, because that aversion treatment got me off into other things. And I came to the dinner feeling a little bit under the weather. And they offered me a regular drink, and I said, no, just a little wine. And I thought that was kind of dainty. They called dinner, and I thought I was doing all right. A little shaky. And I thought, well, you'll make it all right. I remember those lecture in the hospital of these big alcohol molecules. They're very big molecules. They got a hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and a few things. It's kind of a lot of atoms in it. And they break down. And they break into acetaldehyde and sugar and water. And I kind of pictured all these alcohol molecules breaking apart in my liver and that I'd be all right by dessert. And we had roast beef and some mashed potatoes and some little gravy and some vegetable. Next thing I knew, I was down there. I came up slow, hoping nobody would notice. And, they said, "Are you all right, Father?" I said, "Oh, be fine, just a little tired. But I'm taking a nap on the mashed potatoes." And what really made me mad is that I'd get all straightened up and then wake up down there again. I thought it was unfair because I was unaware of this trip down. I was not in on that. You know? And I got to have my second batch of treatments starting the next day. And I went through... 5 batches of treatments over the next 2 years. I wore out the hospital. They asked me never to call them up again. I was demoralizing the other patients and the staff. I was detoxed for the 6th time in a psych ward in downtown Los Angeles, where I think my higher power started to touch me and drag me into the program. I wasn't thinking of program. But right as I was through the major part of detox, it occurred to me that I was going to be drunk again pretty soon. This message came up, "You'll be drunk again pretty soon. You're a flake. There's something wrong with you besides alcoholism. You're alcoholic, that's clear. But besides that, you have something else wrong. You know, you have this, you are incapable of caring. You can't maintain interest in survival. You get bored with the most important things of life. You just kind of, excuse me, bye, you know, out the side door." You get in the middle of a counseling session, and how am I going to get rid of this guy, you know? Because I need a drink to calm down enough to consider how not to drink. And I didn't think they'd understand that. And so I got out of there and went back to New Jersey. I got to winter in Jersey. And I had no idea that deep feeling that I'd be drunk again, I considered that a gift from my higher power. That he let me feel my powerlessness over alcohol directly. Somehow and I didn't have two things wrong with me. I think alcoholism and the inability to care when someone doesn't have a program is all one thing. It's alcoholism. And so I got back there, and I was so sure that AA would not work that I was relaxed at meetings. I went to 8 meetings a week. I liked the meetings that were... you only had to go to 4, but I always went at least to 8 because I liked the guys who were nervous wrecks. I'm going to go someplace. Let's go. I'll go. And so we'd go to meetings, and I... And it was just somehow, I had no idea what ready meant, let alone know if I was ready, you know, for what? What is ready? But the first meetings I went to, people would say things, and somehow it would just go, and just go, ping. And why am I getting happy, you know? I was talking to I got to share at a men's recovery house in Torrance a few months ago, and there was it was a real crowded room. I love real crowded rooms for a meeting. And this guy with steel rim glasses and about 6'4", an intense young man, wanted to talk to me afterwards, and he said, I can't get the spiritual part. I can't get this God thing. I can't get the faith. I just can't get it. But I gotta get it, because I just can't use and drink again. I'll die. I can't get it. But I can't get it. And I said, well, you were listening during the meeting. Yeah, I was listening during the meeting. And we're talking. You got a lot of energy about this thing. And he said, yeah, well, I know that sometimes that sometimes when I'm at meetings, I get glad. And I says, that's God. If you catch yourself getting glad, you've just been visited by the Spirit. The spiritual awakening is starting. You know, if you can connect enough to get glad. If it's fleeting, it's just good. Because getting glad in that way, even though you don't stay with that intensity, it's the real thing. And that's the little fire you blow on and nurture. And then I started getting glad here and there, every place. And I was going into this thing about surrender. I wanted to surrender. I figured, I'm a priest, you know. This is spiritual. Let's do this right. I want to do this in a classy way. So I started researching surrender. And the more I read about surrender, the more discouraged I got. Because I read about phony surrender. You know, that one pamphlet, Dr. Tebow, Surrender versus Compliance in Therapy. And he describes surrender and he describes compliance, which is phony surrender. It's conforming to what you think the wishes of your therapist or your director is so that they'll like you. And then he said, if you do that, it won't work. Well, I always do that. Well, how else do you do anything else? You know? And I really felt worse than ever reading that. And everything, I got to say that everything that I've, my whole mental world, my whole thing of, you know, I have this thing that the big book talks to, we found out that self-knowledge is not enough. And my mental world, it says self-knowledge is enough. It says if you just get understanding of this thing, get it locked in, and get clear, you'll know what to do and you can do it. I also, in my own, in my mental world, this kind of an introverted, neurotic philosopher type, I thought, well, even if it's not just insight, but it's got to be some little formula. I want a formula. And get it clear. I want to get it down, you know. And that's not the way it works. And while I was getting more and more despairing about surrender in the program on an intellectual level, I was actually beginning to surrender, and I didn't notice it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reached his hand out to me and said, Terry, it's time. Take my hand. Well, explain to me first what's going to happen and what, you know. No. Take my hand. But can't we talk about this first? No, you're too sick. Just take my hand and we'll talk on the way. You know. And somehow something in me, I think I had to get glad a few times, and then something in me let AA's hand take me. And I started just doing stuff. I was in the middle of something. I was in the middle of a relationship. You know? I got a new family. I was in a relationship. They were talking to me, and I was answering them. I was saying, yes. Okay, I'll do that. I'll stand by the door. Okay. I'll read the book. Okay. I'll start an inventory. Okay. I'll say my prayer. And all of a sudden, but everything that the program has asked me to do, everything that I have been requested to do by Alcoholics Anonymous seemed so Mickey Mouse, so inconsequential, so lightweight. I mean, I wanted something intense, because that would be it, wouldn't it? You got to get intense. And they said, just don't drink between now and the next meeting. Say hello. Shake hands. Read a book. You really think this is going to do it, huh? And I think they would say from headquarters, no, we don't think that's going to do it. The Spirit does it by touching your heart. And if you take the suggestions, you're in the landing zone. You take the suggestions, you have an open heart. You take the suggestions, you're there when the lightning strikes instead of running away. It's something like that. But it started going. And I don't know, how and when it started. But boy, my own faith. I always believed in God. I identified with people who were spiritual. And I thought, they're on the right track. That's authentic. I want that. That's good. Yes. That's not just self-deception, man. I think I'll have a drink while I think about this more deeply. I couldn't relate the drinking, to just the basic alienation. And I could, as I begin to click, and I just get involved with the program, there's something very deep inside, and I'm assuming it's the same with you. Something deep. I just got so excited that something worked. I mean, that a conversation would work. I was so used to having conversations that didn't mean a thing, and I wouldn't respect you if you took me seriously. If you believe what I was saying, I mean, don't you know? Don't you know I can't stand behind what I say, and that it just all... And Alcoholics Anonymous, and this give and take we have, I realized, I'm beginning to mean what I say. I didn't deliberately not mean what I said before. It's that I couldn't mean what I said. It's a discovery that we're able to mean it. We're able to listen to someone enough and have our heart touched and then say something back spontaneously. I was finding myself in conversations where I hadn't checked out how I was doing in the conversation for a whole minute or two. Just having an automatic, honest-to-God contact with another human being. I wasn't doing that. When you're a drinking alcoholic, you don't do that. Where it's the most cruel isolation in the world. And something was real excited, and my own vision, though, is that if you really get going in the spiritual trip, you'll get kind of a comprehensive view and habit. But this thing just says, no, accept the fact that you're a dingbat alcoholic, that you're emotionally immature, that you're a pathetic egomaniac. Not just kind of egomaniac, but the kind who gets depressed when anyone else is praised in your presence. Except the fact that you're afraid of everybody. You're not just afraid of this or that person. I'm afraid of Debbie at Denny's. I want to be a good customer and be approved. If I try on 2 pairs of shoes in the store, I feel obliged. He's got a family to support, I'm discovering you're this craven people pleaser, egomaniac, with a dirty mind. And then everybody in the program said, yeah, that's good. God works fine with your type, lots of experience. That's your wiring, that's your MO. Don't have a drink and play ball. Don't have a drink and play ball, and you get to have a life and recover and become accustomed to the embarrassment of being emotionally immature.
the egomaniac, craven people pleaser with a dirty mind, who doesn't have to act on those feelings nearly with the consistency you've had before. That you actually can show up and do stuff and have exchanges where that are important. And it was so great seeing Milt here, where you are right now, but it brought back, you know, a scene, a wonderful scene of my early sobriety where I was, I met Milt, one of the first people I met in AA in Los Angeles. And he was working with the post office and busting mailmen and mail persons with their alcohol stuff. And he invited me, I don't know, when you're kind of new, people don't invite you places, they command you. They say, come over to our house at 10, you know, or whatever that is. So I got the command, and I went over, and I met Dick B., the first guy, and he assigned me to sponsor Dick B. And being in Milt's place above the Ballion Market on 6th and St. Andrews, with Dick B. and Milt and Ruby, and having the solemn assignment of sponsoring this guy, who was quite an alky. One thing I was going to tell about, I don't want to tell someone else's story, but Dick actually, because he was on probation, he had to bring a doctor's note if he missed work. And he'd missed 2 days, so he stole someone's script, some dope fiend's script from a doctor, and forged a note and gave it to his supervisor very proudly. And the supervisor said, I don't get it. Well, you said I'm supposed to bring a note if I miss work. And he said, but you were here. That was the... Couldn't pass that up. But Dick and I got along very well, and he's sober today. And that sense of being in a community where things actually, where life starts to work. And of course, my old head, my old idea is life working means me becoming excellent and poised. Life working means winning prizes and being admired and feeling good. And then when life really starts to work, where you remain a dingbat alcoholic with noticeable character defects, emotional immaturity, egomania, people-pleasing syndrome, and a dirty mind, and you remain all that while you start a day at a time acting like a responsible person, connecting with people and having joy in your heart because you make a connection and you're living your life and doing steps, the real thing is just different enough from the dream to be a little confusing, you know. Because I still have the dream. I still have the old sick dream, the old ego dream of achieving security and happiness by becoming excellent and over everything. You know? And we don't have to get over everything. And it's funny, the more deeply we're willing never to be over alcoholism, we don't drink. And I think that works on the other things, but I'm finding myself slipping into a sermon when I'm talk about that. And I want to finish before the other speakers did so far, so that you'll like me and be grateful. Guess I was right. And what, can I say the one more thing, Silly? Okay, one more thing was the, even with what I'm saying about that connection being this joy, one of my major problems to begin with was when people say, you know, when all else fails, work with the drunk, when, you know, you're not doing this inventory just for you to feel better. This is so you're better fitted to be of service to others. And when I'd read that, my heart would sink. Because when I'm alone in my room, I'm not interested in being of service to others. It's very embarrassing. If you're a priest, you've been trained to be of service. And I'm just not interested. I want to become well-adjusted and happy. And if God and I have the time after that, terrific. But what I notice is that when I come early and stay late and get involved, that I'm tricked into being of service. And when I'm tricked into it, I love it. Because I'm just like you. I'm made to be of service. I can't stand it. Either I get to be of service or I burn the place down. I need my turn. As soon as I get my turn, I'm grateful for it and hope you don't bother me again very long. And then it goes on, you know. We stay. If you don't get a taste for the best, fine. Just play ball and be in the middle of it. Thank you very much.